headlines. An airbase hosting American troops comes under attack in Iraq's Anbar province hours after drones targeted a U.S. base at Erbil Airport. Afghan officials say government forces have taken control of the capital city of Badghis province following Taliban militants' attack. And the Haitian president is assassinated in his home in what has been called an inhumane and barbaric act amid rising political violence in the Caribbean nation. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. This is the second such attack this week on the base in Iraq's western Anbar province. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition said two people were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Ain al-Assad was also hit by three rockets on Monday. The latest attack came less than a day after drones hit another U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan region. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. Anti-American sentiments run high in the Arab country since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in January of last year. Political analyst Barry Grossman says the U.S. seeks to keep its bases in Iraq to carry out military operations in the region from the Arab nation.
All of these bases are used for all manner of things, not just by conventional U.S. military forces and their so-called allies, but by CIA players as well. And we all know that they've all been very active in the region for a very long time, not just in Iraq, but throughout the region, including most significantly in Syria, but in other places too. And all of these bases serve a function in providing the facilities needed in order to carry out these black ops. And they also provide a basis for the U.S. presence there and their efforts through the usual tactics to basically lobby or compel elements within the Iraq government to not stand in their way and to continue to receive them on the ground and allow them to carry on operations from Iraq, however disruptive and unnecessary those operations might be. So the U.S. Does not want to leave. There's too much money to be made. There are too many agendas to be pursued in the region that depend on having some kind of footprint on the ground.
The U.S. military base located near Syria's Al Omar oil field in Deir al-Zor has reportedly come under attack. Reports say that several mortar shells hit the base just 3 days after a barrage of rockets targeted the same facility in eastern Syria. The attacks follow amid growing anger over last week's U.S. airstrikes against resistance groups near the Iraq-Syria border. Hundreds of American troops are stationed in northeastern Syria without the permission of Damascus. The Syrian government describes the U.S. military as illegitimate. Damascus has also lambasted the U.S. military, taking over the country's largest oil field. Afghanistan's Interior Ministry says government forces have taken full control of Qala'ina, a city that was stormed by the Taliban militant group. The ministry says the capital city of Badghis province is now clear of militants. It said the Taliban suffered heavy casualties. The group began its assault early in the morning and even briefly seized police headquarters and offices of the country's intelligence agency. This was their first major assault on a provincial capital. The militants have increased their attacks on Afghan cities and villages since May and have already seized dozens of rural districts. A correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, says the security situation in Afghanistan is getting worse by the day.
The security situation is worsening day by day in Afghanistan, particularly in northern and western part of this country. And Badghis is also located in northwest of Afghanistan. Badghis in northwest of Afghanistan is located very close to Faryab in north of Afghanistan. And Faryab is also known as one of the key and, of course, strategic parts of this country. Anybody or any group who has the control over Faryab, it means that it has the control over the entire northern parts of this country, including the strategic Balkh province that is located in the border with Tajikistan as well as in Uzbekistan. Another key province in northern Afghanistan is Kunduz, and alongside this province, Tahar is also considered as one of the strategic provinces. Badakhshan is another province in northeastern Afghanistan that nowadays, most of the districts of this province have been fallen to the hands of the Taliban militant group. But local officials in Faizabad, the capital city of Badakhshan province, say that Afghan security forces are struggling to take back the ousted areas from the Taliban militants.
Iran's foreign minister says the people and leaders of Afghanistan must make difficult decisions for the future of their country. Mohammad Javad Zarif referred to the years-long failed presence of American troops and its destructive consequences. He called on the Afghan leaders and political movements to return to the negotiating table and to commit to political solutions. Iran's top diplomat also announced Tehran's readiness to assist the process of that dialogue, solving the ongoing crises in Afghanistan. Zarif made the comments during a meeting between prominent Afghan figures and the Taliban's political delegation in Tehran. Political commentator Fuad Azadi says reaching stability and peace in Afghanistan is not easy, and that Iran is trying to alleviate the problems between the sides by hosting the Afghan peace talks.
The hope that Iran has is that finally we may get to peace with U.S. Troops leaving Afghanistan, at least a good portion of the American troops leaving Afghanistan. Iran hopes to see peace. We are going to go through a period of instability, and Iran is worried about more bloodshed in Afghanistan. Having a peaceful Afghanistan is obviously good for Iran and other neighbors of Afghanistan. It's also good for people in Afghanistan. Achieving that goal of reaching a settlement in Afghanistan and achieving peace is not going to be easy. If it was easy, it would have been done a long time ago. Hosting the meeting today in Tehran between the different parties that are having difficulties in Afghanistan is a step by Iran to basically see if difficulties and problems can be resolved.
Dozens of Palestinian Bedouins have become homeless after Israeli forces demolished their tents in a village in the occupied West Bank.
This is the seventh time that occupation commits this heinous crime. This crime is committed against our people, against the women, the children, the elderly. This is evidence that the occupation state is carrying out state-sponsored terrorism against the Palestinian existence. Now 63 Palestinians became homeless, 11 families had their homes demolished and confiscated. Even the water tanks that a Palestinian citizen uses to provide water for his family and his livestock, they were confiscated and destroyed by the occupation.
Basharat, who is working with the Palestinian Authority, highlighted the plight of Bedouins and the destruction of their tents by the regime to make room for Israeli settlers. That after bulldozers backed by Israeli forces tore down the Palestinian structures and threw the remains in dump trucks. Israelis claim the land was cleared since it was in a military firing range. The Israeli regime has destroyed Palestinian homes, including those of Bedouins, citing similar pretexts in the past. Rights groups have time and again denounced Israel's demolition drive and the forced expulsion of Palestinians. They are arguing that Israel's land grab policy is aimed at expanding its settlements, which are illegal under international law. The political and economic crises are deepening in Lebanon amid a political division on the formation of a new government after almost 11 months. Lebanon is short of being called a failed state, but who would actually gain from Lebanon's downfall? Sanctions placed by the U.S. and France have prevented a major investment from taking place in the country, which puts their motive into question. Meanwhile, the Hezbollah chief has accused the U.S. of creating instability.
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents, and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death prevent the demise of Lebanon. Diab has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon, despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come.
The issues surrounding Lebanon's crisis are truly staggering. The economic and financial crises are possibly on top of the most severe issues in the country since the mid-19th century. GDP per capita has fallen by around 40% in dollar terms. Such a brutal contraction is usually associated with conflicts or wars, and it doesn't help when Saudi Arabia pulls all of its funds out of Lebanese banks.
Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened, with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, has been assassinated in an overnight attack on his private residence by a group of unidentified assailants. In a statement, interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph described the killing of the country's president as an inhumane and barbaric act. The statement said the armed men attacked Moïse's residence on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, fatally killing him and injuring the First Lady. Joseph said that he is now in charge of Haiti and pledged to take measures to protect the country amid reports of sporadic gunfire in the capital. The high-profile killing occurred amid a rising wave of politically linked violence in the Caribbean nation. Haiti also faces chronic poverty and recurrent natural disasters. There are fears that the assassination of the head of the state could spark a widespread disorder. Journalist and commentator Kim Eves says a foreign country could be behind the assassination of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse.
This looks like an operation which was funded either by a foreign government or by a very large mafia, whether that mafia was foreign or whether it was a combine of the U.S. of Haitian bourgeois families, many of whom were against Jovenel because he had taken back some of the perks they had in the past. So the population, yes, was calling for Jovenel to go, to leave power, but I don't know that they thought that it would be in this manner that he would leave. Haiti has been basically a neo-colony of the United States since U.S. Marines first invaded the country in 1915. They stayed there for 19 years till 1934, and then they invaded again in 1994 and in 2004. Each time they just stayed for about 3 months, and then they passed off the foreign military occupation to the UN. Washington has been the kingmaker and coup maker in Haiti basically for the last century.
The World Health Organization sounds the alarm on the country's lack of resources in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic.
While we are progressing controlling the pandemic, it remains in a very dangerous phase. The only way out is to support countries in the equitable distribution of personal protective equipment, tests, treatments, and vaccines.
The WHO chief Tedros Adhanom said countries that control the supply of instruments to fight the coronavirus are easing restrictions. This is while countries without access to sufficient supplies are facing waves of hospitalizations and death. Tedros also said that the WHO's global appeal for funding for coronavirus equipment is still $17 billion short, almost half of its total needs. COVID-19 is spreading around the world with more than 180 million confirmed cases and around 4 million deaths across nearly 200 countries. Officials in the Australian state of New South Wales extend a coronavirus lockdown in Sydney amid a rise in cases related to the Delta variant of the virus. The state prime minister said the reason for the extension is that the Delta variant is a game changer as it is more transmissible. The decision comes after the state reported 27 new cases. Sydney has been under a lockdown since June 26 after a Delta variant outbreak. The city's total infections now top 350. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
Boris Johnson is to announce that the lifting of most remaining COVID-19 restrictions in England will go ahead on 19th of July amid a backlash from government scientific advisers who have warned that doing so would be like building a new variant factory. Despite cases having risen to their highest level since January of 2021, the Prime Minister is set to press ahead with the final stage of unlocking in 2 weeks. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Overy Allegretti and Linda Geeds. The piece is titled, PM to Confirm 19 July End to COVID Rules Despite Scientists' Warnings. Boris Johnson is to announce that the lifting of most remaining COVID-19 restrictions in England will go ahead on 19th of July amid a backlash from government scientific advisers who have warned that doing so would be like building new variant factories. Despite cases having risen to their highest level since January of 2021, the Prime Minister is set to press ahead with the final stage of unlocking in 2 weeks. In a Downing Street press conference on Monday afternoon, 5th of July, Boris Johnson announced that with 86% of adults in the United Kingdom having had at least a first jab, the government will move from relying on legal curbs to control people's behavior to letting individuals make their own decisions. Changes to be announced include allowing fully vaccinated adults to travel to amber list countries without having to self-isolate when they return home, making the wearing a face mask voluntary, apart from in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and no longer requiring fully vaccinated adults to self-isolate if they have come into contact with an infected person. The school bubble system that has forced hundreds of thousands of pupils to quarantine at home if someone in their bubble tested positive is also expected to be dropped, while pub and restaurant customers may no longer have to scan an NHS QR code. The different approach to tackling COVID was supported by the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, who claimed it will be impossible to eradicate the disease and that the country would have to find ways to cope with it, as with the flu. The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, also said the health arguments for opening up were compelling, but conceded dangerous new variants of coronavirus could emerge that current vaccines were ineffective against. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is due to reveal the results of government reviews into social distancing and COVID status certificates as well. The Guardian revealed last week that ministers were planning to remove all mandatory mask and social distancing restrictions in England from 19th of July, though national guidance may remain in place, encouraging caution in high-risk areas, such as on public transport. COVID status certificates, an idea that Boris Johnson once championed as a way to allow access to places such as theatres for those who can prove that they have been vaccinated, had a recent negative test result, or have antibodies, are also expected to be ditched, though government sources have hinted they could be reintroduced in the winter. Conservative MPs who were once more cautious have mostly been convinced the time is right for mass unlocking, with one saying it was becoming clear rising infections were not remotely correlated to hospitalizations or deaths, so we just got to get on with it. But another Tory figure warned the science may become a second thought after 19th of July. Robert Jenrick, the community secretary, revealed on Sky News he would shed his face mask as soon as possible, while Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said he would carry on wearing a face mask indefinitely when in an enclosed, crowded space. Concern is building among scientists about the new wave of infections in the United Kingdom and ministers' determination to press on with unlocking. Stephen Riker, a professor at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, who is also a member of the government subcommittee advising on behavioural science, said, "It is frightening to have a health secretary who still thinks COVID is flu, who is unconcerned at levels of infection, who doesn't realise that those who do best for health also do best for the economy, who wants to ditch all protections while only half of us are vaccinated." He added, "Above all, it's frightening to have a health secretary who wants to make all protections a matter of personal choice, when the key message of the pandemic is, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing." Professor Susan Michie, the director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London, who sits on the same subcommittee, said, "Allowing community transmission to surge is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate." Meanwhile, a further 24,248 cases were reported in the United Kingdom on Sunday, 4th of July, up from 15,953 cases on the same day the previous week. There were a further 15 deaths. The northeast of England recorded a particular surge in infections, with South Tyneside reporting a 195% increase in the 7 days to 29th of June. Gateshead, a 142% increase, and Sunderland, a 131% increase. Only Oxford and Tamworth have recorded greater increases during this period, with all five areas having a prevalence of between 480 and 585 coronavirus cases per 100,000 of the population. "Something weird is happening in the northeast of England, and it's a bit worrying," said Christina Pagel, a professor of operational research at University College London. "Not only were cases there rising rapidly, so were hospitalizations and the proportion of tests recording a positive result," she said. Other scientists are saying the relaxation of many of the restrictions, while not risk-free, do make sense.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Inside Israel.
Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holocaust right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's Ynet News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room, without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the Immigration Authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-age children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Bryn says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help.
So yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking, and you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews. I was in the trial yesterday of Salomon Tuka, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. Then he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there is a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established the Zionists, that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been there. Their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as less, not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was canceled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister has he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator. and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. Neither it doesn't respect international law, the refugee convention, the Geneva Convention. Sorry, it has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries. I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk on these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Can public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change, because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through, Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now, it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.